Hey, folks, thanks for listening to the podcast. I want to let you know that the show is sponsored by Hulu Plus. Hulu Plus is amazing. It's like having a TV and a movie theater in your pocket. It lets you binge on thousands of hit shows anytime, anywhere, on your TV, PC, smartphone, tablet, doesn't matter. And I want you guys to really experience it the way I am. So through this podcast, we're able to offer you a two-week free trial offer to check it out. Real simple. Go to HuluPlus.com/Paul or go to SideshowNetwork.tv and click on the Hulu Plus banner. You get 2 free weeks, and when you do that, sign up. It also helps support this podcast. We get credit for it, and we'd really appreciate that. So please check it out. I think you're going to fall in love with it. It's SideshowNetwork.tv and click on the Hulu Plus banner or HuluPlus.com/Paul.
Warriors, come out to play. Warriors, come out to play.
One gang could run this city. One gang. Nothing would move without us allowing it to happen.
Hey, folks, this week on the podcast, very excited to have on my dear friend and acting coach and America's preeminent acting coach, Bob Krakauer. And I mean that. Bob is the guy in America when it comes to acting. Everybody has an opinion about acting. You do, I do, my grandmother does, but this is the guy whose opinion matters. Major Hollywood studios look to him, major directors look to him, actors look to him to get great performances. He's amazing. I wanted to have this conversation with him for a while because I wanted people to hear what goes into good acting, what makes good acting, what's involved in making that happen, what's involved in bad acting. It's a really, really interesting conversation that's going to open your eyes to acting and what actors have to go through to get great performances. Bob's amazing. He's worked with the likes of Josh Duhamel, John Slattery from Mad Men, Louis C.K., Louis Black, Laurie Metcalf. He's worked on Golden Globe-winning shows, Emmy-winning shows. He's the guy. He's been involved in casting of NYPD Blue, My So-Called Life, Arliss, Varsity Blues. This is something you really want to hear. And if you want to check me out doing stand-up, this week I'm going to be in New York City at all the major clubs. You can see where I'm going to be by going to my website, paulmercurio.com, on Facebook, Paul Mercurio, or follow me on Twitter, at Paul Mercurio.
We got the streets, suckers! Can you dig it?
All right, I'm welcoming to the podcast this week. I'm very excited. My good, dear friend, Bob Krakauer, brilliant director, acting coach, dear friend, and just somebody that I want everyone to know and understand, like, what he does and how important he is to the acting community. Welcome to the podcast, buddy.
I'm very, very happy to be here.
Thank you.
I really am.
As you said, I have no idea why you're talking to me.
I really have no idea, but I'm always happy to talk to you.
Because you're like a guiding light in my life, and the people in the world should know that there are people in the world like you out there. Bob is based in New York City, but also has been based in Los Angeles and is the quintessential acting coach in Hollywood and in New York City. Like, he's the guy. He's the godfather. In fact,
I'm the guy. I'm the guy.
Well, you are. Like, you're the guy. Like, you are the guy. If you work with Bob, hopefully you know you're doing something right, and Bob is going to help you fix whatever's wrong and is the guy that studios call on, directors call on at the highest level to come in and work with people and has shaped a lot of careers. I mean, but there's a quote that I want to start with by Michael Lembeck, who is called the most passionate, kindest, and brightest approach I've seen in teaching and acting, coaching, and acting. And I think that that's absolutely right. Like, you have this incredible empathy for actors, although you've never really formally acted a lot yourself.
No.
And you've got this ability, you have street smarts and an ability to kind of know human nature. And I want to talk about where that came from, because you started so young at Tufts. You were an English and a philosophy major, right?
Strange as that may seem now, yes.
And then you were in an acting class, and people spotted that you had the ability to help people. And how is that how this all started for you?
Yeah, a guy named Downing Kless, who was an acting teacher at Tufts. I was taking the class to satisfy a requirement.
Just like an easy credit.
Well, an easy credit and a way to meet women. And
nice.
The parties I heard were very good there. He said to me at one point, you know, there were these auditions for summer theaters, and he said, "Listen, I'd like you to help people work on their monologues." And I was like, "Right, this is the first class I've ever taken in theater. I don't know that maybe I'm the guy." but he goes, "No, I think you might be the guy." And so I helped out, and it just felt right. I didn't know what I was doing, but I knew what I was doing.
But what felt right about it? I mean, just so people understand, you've coached people the likes of Josh Duhamel, John Slattery, Louis C.K., Reba McEntire. You've directed major plays like Boy's Life, The Three Sisters, Chekhov's, and coached in film as well. So obviously, there was something going on very early on, even though you didn't know what it was. What do you think it was that was a connection for you in doing that kind of thing?
Well, I'm not totally sure. Nobody's ever actually asked me that, Paul. I'm so surprised that it would have been you.
I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad
no,
thing.
It's a wonderful thing. It's actually one of the things you know that I love about you. I don't know how to answer that except because I know you know something about athletics. It's, you know, how do you know when you have a good fastball? I mean, you know, yeah. You just know. I realized early on through whatever doubt and insecurity there was that I had an instinct for something, even though I couldn't name it and didn't
right.
intellectually understand it. But it was the combination of feeling like I actually knew something about something. It's the kind of thing that kind of helps you look in the mirror at night and feel okay.
And you weren't crazy, just so people understand, at 24, Bob became the director of the American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco, the youngest person in America to ever hold a position like that, and then went on to Louisville to work with a famed director there and put on major productions. And what I think you have, and I've worked with other coaches, that no one else has is what I call it. I mean, this, you went to Tufts.
Right.
Very bright guy, brought up in New Jersey. You have a street smart. You have street smarts and an instinct for human nature that a lot of teachers that I've worked with don't have. And I don't know if it's because I know you spent time in Brighton Beach with your grandfather. He's got had a Knish bar. And, and did you get it from that, from being around those kind of people in that environment?
I think I benefited actually from not coming up in a theater environment. I mean, not that my mom liked going to plays and stuff.
Yeah.
But I wasn't raised in theater or raised in a theatrical environment. I was raised in an upper middle class home,
right.
Middle class to upper middle class home in New Jersey, and didn't have any aspirations toward theater whatsoever. I was, even as a kid, I was interested in, you know, what makes people tick and why people do what they do. And so I think that's always been germane to my personality, but it wasn't like I was looking to do theater. So by the time I came around to this in my late teens, early 20s, really in my 20s, all of my background had been based, you know, in listening to my friends complain about their girlfriends,
right.
And trying to figure stuff out. There was a brief period where in studying philosophy, it was also psychology.
Yeah.
I mean, so that, I think that particular interest has always been true for me.
Well, you have that ability. Like in a class, what he'll do is you'll say, you want to make the point, and then you always have a perfect analogy or example from life. You know, like when you're at the bar with your buddies and you want and I can't tell you how few people have the ability to tap into that reservoir to convey a point in an acting class. Because at the end of the day, it's about acting is about, and I'm going to have you talk about this because you're the expert, relationships and portraying those relationships accurately and honestly. where you have that ability, and I'm fascinated as to where that, and I guess you're saying it's a combination of the way you were brought up and your education, to be able to be, to tap into the psychology of it all.
Well, I think part of it is you have to have a curiosity about it. You know, it's like, I was actually just talking to a friend about this outside before we came in, right? You have an ability to walk people up to a line. I mean, I've seen you get people to say things in public I'm not sure they would even say in private.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
and in part, it's because, like, when I watch you, it's because you're genuinely curious. You're not trying to hurt anybody.
No.
No, it's really genuinely interesting to you. Where does that interest come from? I'm not really sure. I'm not trying to cop out on the answer because I do understand what you're asking.
I think it's similar to my upbringing in the way I grew up in a furniture store selling furniture when I was 11 or 12 to women with blue hair at 60. And
right.
You just had to have a gift for gab and whatever. And I'm just in knowing you and knowing your background a little bit, I got to believe those summers in Brighton Beach probably helped and being around that kind of world.
Well, I loved it. I mean, I really did. I mean, my what you're talking about, my grandfather ran a Knishan beer stand, just off on the boardwalk off of Brighton 5th Street. And I loved hanging around there.
Yeah.
And I loved hanging around the old guys playing pinochle. And what I really loved about it was, it was a very unusual thing. He was next to the Boardwalk Men's Club, which probably doesn't exist anymore. It was a bunch of old Jewish guys playing pinochle and drinking beer and eating knishes and doing whatever else they were doing. Yeah. There were no women allowed, none, except one, which was my grandmother. And even at a young age, just the fascination of why her? I mean, she's a loud-mouthed, angry, like, why her?
Right.
And you knew that these guys had some respect for her, though it was very unclear as to why. And so I think part of it also is being an only child, in which you're a situation where you're left to kind of figure stuff out for yourself. And in those days, parents, it's not like today. I mean, you know, I go everywhere with my kid. But, you know, in the 60s, and that's not a knock against my parents, who I love. That's just the way it was. I mean, everybody did it, right? So you're left to figure a lot of stuff out for yourself. And I always found it fascinating.
How much is the psychology aspect of acting important? I mean, if you want to put a percentage on it or whatever, but, like, you know, you talk about in your coaching, I've seen it. I've been on the receiving end of it. You have to be part cheerleader, part technician, part psychologist. All of these things rolled into one that you can't really learn. Like, I think it's either in you or it's not in you.
I think that's right.
And how do you know when to push what button with somebody? And, you know, over time, is that sort of, you've gotten, I would imagine, more efficient at knowing, like, okay, Paul needs this here, Sarah needs this there. Like, how does that come about?
A lot of it is having faith in one's own ability, and a lot of it is trust in other people. Generically, I trust other people. I don't mistrust them,
right?
So when I look in somebody's eyes, I believe what they're telling me, right? For example, because it's the two of us, like, from the moment you came into class, I was like, okay, here's a guy I can mess with a little bit. Here's a guy that, right, because every class needs some humor.
Yes.
Right? And we looked at each other. I was like, okay, it's like making a friend. Yeah. We're on the same wavelength.
I felt like I knew you for 10 years.
Right, immediately. Yeah. Well, but that has nothing to do with teaching or anything else. That's just a human instinct, right? It's a good feeling. And then you go a little slow. You try to figure out how far you can go with it. But you're actually doing it not only for that human being, right, but also because it releases a lot of pressure in the class when you find somebody that's in on the joke,
right?
Having fun, in my opinion, having fun is at the core of everything, because if it's not fun, it's hard to build trust in a creative environment.
Right.
And the fun is in failing,
yeah,
because it's all failure and mistakes. And how do you know that? Well, because nobody wants to make one. Well, if nobody wants to make one, then we must all make them. So you try to make it fun,
right,
to make the mistakes.
Right.
And there are people who are uptight about that, and there are people who are not. You were not.
Hey, folks, thanks for checking out the podcast. Paul here. I want to talk to you about Hulu Plus. I really want you guys to check this out. I signed up for it and absolutely love it, and it's changed the way I watch TV and movies and probably saved my life. Last week, I'm stuck on a plane. The TV screen in the seat in front of me is not working. I've got nothing to do in a 3.5-hour flight, and an insurance salesman sitting next to me who's trying to sell me life insurance like you wouldn't believe, to the point where I'm thinking the only way I'm going to get away from this guy is if I buy life insurance and then jump out of the plane. Instead, I put on Hulu Plus, and everything was right with the world. I watched 5 episodes back-to-back of The Twilight Zone. How great is that series? Rod Serling, old school. That's the great thing about Hulu Plus. You can watch current TV shows, old TV shows, Friday Night SmackDown, Community. You want it, it's got it. It's a TV in your pocket. Really fast downloads. I want you guys to check it out. We're going to offer you a 2-week free trial period because you're listeners to this podcast. It's really simple. Go to HuluPlus.com/Paul or SideshowNetwork.tv and click on the Hulu Plus banner. You get 2 free weeks, and when you sign up, we get credit for it, and it helps support this podcast, which we really appreciate. You're going to love it. You're going to enjoy it. You're going to tell your friends about it. Go check it out. It's HuluPlus.com/Paul or SideshowNetwork.tv and click on the Hulu Plus banner. If you like it after 2 weeks, it's only $7.99 a month, $8 a month. I spend $8 a month on penicillin shots.
So when you ask how far do you know how to push, in essence, people tell you how far you can or cannot push.
See, but that's the brilliance of you, that you have that ability to read people. I can't tell you how many acting coaches and directors are terrible at reading people.
Which seems amazing. Right. That would
right?
be true.
I mean, you're a great director as well. And it's, and I have to tell you, being in your class is the purest form of what I'm doing right now, because it's freeing, because you're just doing it for the it. For the art of it, and it's just, and it's, and I love, it's the nature of my stand-up is to interact with people, and I love interacting with people, and it's about relationships, and that's what acting is about. And you
yeah.
create a really great, creative, safe environment for a person to like grow creatively and artistically. And I don't know, is that something when you were at the American Conservatory Theater with Fletcher and Ball.
Right.
Talk about the influence that they had on you and who those people were in your life.
Well, it would be hard to, Alan Fletcher is someone to whom I owe a lot, and it's a debt I can never repay. Ironically, he was not like that at all. He was a kind of angry and uptight and silent dude.
Really?
But for some reason, yeah. And a guy that a lot of people were afraid of, but for some reason, but brilliant, by the way, absolutely brilliant. For some reason, he and I got along extremely well, mm-hmm. even though I was 22 and he was, I guess, 62 or whatever he was. And I think part of it was that I was put in a position where I was assisting him on some things. And he was a guy that people asked a lot of questions of. And yet he was somebody who hated to talk, which was really strange.
Yeah, it's a bizarre business to be in.
So I had, we had a thing. I mean, I was able to sort of, he didn't like to be alone. And so I was good company for him because I didn't really put any demands on him. Mm. And in return, he taught me a lot of stuff because I didn't ask him anything.
But did he teach you things overtly or just by your observation?
No, by observation. And but he knew that. Like he would occasionally, like, you know, I'd be in a rehearsal with him and he would lean over and say something. Mm-hmm. He would see me looking at something a certain way and say and point something out. And it was all very on the fly and very unstructured. But what he allowed me to do was to be present every minute of every day for anything and everything as much as I wanted to be. Mm. And that brought me into contact with other members of the company. And so the other thing was everybody, even at that age, 22, I knew I wanted to teach. And there aren't too many 22-year-olds who want to teach anything,
yeah.
let alone acting. So, you know, people there was no competitive streak. In other words, I wanted to do something nobody else wanted to do. Yeah. So people were pretty helpful. Ironically, though, for me, the most important job I had in terms of teaching acting was I was an assistant to Susan Smith, who was an agent here in New York. Mm-hmm. And when I was there, I learned the difference between, you know, great acting is nice, but being a working actor would be better.
Why is that?
Because you can pay your insurance and take your girlfriend out to dinner and pay for your car.
Well, can't you do that if you're a great actor? Or it's just...
No, because there's a lot of great actors, and we see them in New York all the time, who are great, but they can't book a Law and Order, right? They're great theater actors, but they can't do TV or don't know how to do it or can't adjust. And I learned a lot from her, and then eventually from... my first casting job was on NYPD Blue. Right. And as it turned out, Stephen Bochco's acting teacher was also Alan Fletcher.
Oh, is that right?
So I totally lucked out. And I learned a lot in the process of watching people that I thought were great actors who weren't getting jobs and people I didn't think were so great who were working all the time.
And what did you learn, and what was the distinction that you figured out there?
I think... this is going to sound extremely strange. What I learned is that to some degree, acting can't be taught.
Right.
There are skills that can be taught. There are talent that can be cultivated if you can recognize it. But that ultimately, acting is something we all do every day. Because if we didn't, we would probably be dead.
Explain that. Elaborate on that.
Well, you are working at a restaurant and the customer is driving you completely crazy.
Right.
But you can't yell at the customer or hit the customer, though you might feel like it. You have to behave in a way that allows you to get a good tip. Otherwise, what's the point of the job?
Right.
So... in spite of the fact that you would like so much
to take the knife,
to just reach for the carving knife and stick it in their neck, you find yourself smiling, saying, "Is there anything else, sir? May I help you with?"
And that's behavior, and that's acting, and you're doing that because you want to protect your job and pay your bills, and blah, 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 blah.
Right. So one of the things that I learned along the way was there are a lot of skills taught in traditional acting classes about emotional life and all of that. And they're all very good things to teach. But ultimately, actors are engaged in the act of telling stories. And the stories tend to be a series of events, which they have been, you know, since cave people roamed the earth. Mm. People tell each other stories. It's a way of not feeling so alone. It's a way of connecting. It's a way of communicating. And TV and film especially is storytelling based. And most actors don't really know how to do that because they're consumed with their own part of it.
So one of the things I wanted to get to is, what is the biggest hurdle you have to deal with? Is there a common thing in dealing with actors at the highest level and lower level actors that you're always battling? Is it that they're in their own head too much? They're thinking about their own performance too much? They're not in relationship in the scene? Like
Yes. I mean, the biggest problem you have is that, and it's understandable. I mean, if I hand you a script and ask you to take these words on a piece of paper and turn it into a flesh and blood human being, it's understandable that you would be burdened, even if you were excited by it, you would be burdened by the task of turning that into a living, breathing person, and you would naturally ask questions about how you felt and where you were from and all of that stuff. But a lot of times, those questions and those answers actually don't help anybody do anything, as it turns out, because the scenes are written the same way. Like, if I ask you, tell me about your night last night. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your night.
Well, I went to, worked on The Daily Show, left, went home.
Right. Dinner. So you're going to tell me what happened. You're going to tell me a series of events.
Right.
You're not going to say, if I say, tell me about your night, you're going to say, well, I felt sad, and then I was mad, and then I was glad. You're not gonna answer.
It's that simple, isn't it?
Yeah.
And why is it that it's been mucked up and made so complicated? Is it because it's just because there are teachers out there that want to overcomplicate things, that people get too head heady about all of this?
I think it's because, look, if you've ever been in an acting class where people cried, mm-hmm. right, it feels like something has happened, mm-hmm. right? It doesn't feel like, you know, you think, oh, look, Paul's crying. Oh, my God, isn't that great? Mm-hmm. But, you know, as there's an old quote from an acting teacher named Bobby Lewis, which I think goes something like, if acting were crying, my Aunt Rivka would be Dooza. I think I have that right. and yet, somehow, especially for younger actors, acting gets reduced to that emotional connection. And it's not that it's unimportant.
Right.
You have to be connected. But the bottom line is, if you're waiting tables, you need to get a tip.
Right. Right.
And you need to do whatever you need to do to get the tip.
Which might involve some acting.
Which is probably going to involve some acting.
Right.
Right? There's a great Chris Rock thing about lying, right?
Right.
Which I think, I'm paraphrasing wildly, is, you know, men tell the most lies and women tell the biggest.
Right. Right.
But one of the things he says, which is funny, but it's sort of true, is, you know, when he's talking about women, is, you know, you're wearing heels. You're not that tall. You're wearing extensions. Your hair don't look like that.
Right.
Right. The man, it's like, I'm at Paul's house. No, you're not.
Right.
And so we do it all day, every day, as a way of getting things that we want. Right. It's not ultimately that complicated.
But is it manipulation or is it acting?
Well, it depends whether you think the word manipulation is positive or negative. And the truth is that we all manipulate each other in various ways to get what we want. The question is, you know, do we do it with any integrity or honesty? Do we do it? When you start to work with an audience, are you not manipulating them?
Oh, sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But not in a mean way.
No.
Right. So again, and it's the word is, that word tends to be charged with a negative connotation. I'm not really sure that that's ultimately true.
What is the thing that the average person listening would not, that you'd impart on them to understand just how difficult acting is, or what goes on is involved in good acting that they may not? I mean, because everybody's a critic, right? I always say this. Everybody's got an opinion about movies, TV shows, comedy. My mother, everybody, right? Everybody's a director. Everybody's a whatever, right?
Right.
Well, what is the thing, you know, sort of in terms of whether it's technical or emotional or both, that people don't really understand, that should understand about good acting and how you get to good acting?
I'm not sure this is going to answer your question, but here's the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, Les Mis, the movie, mm-hmm. the musical?
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of incredible to me that a lot of singers or theater actors were putting it down, right? Like, oh, so-and-so isn't that great a singer, and so-and-so. You know, here's what I would say to them. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to learn a song. Then I want you to stand in your kitchen and sing it a cappella with a metronome in your ear. Then I'm going to get a crew of 150 people, and I'm going to surround you, and then I'm going to put hot lights on you. Then I'm going to take a big old camera, and I'm going to stick it up your nose. And then I'm going to tell you that we only have time to do this 6 times, so you better not make any mistakes. And that means anybody, right? You can't flub a line. You can't miss a note. You can't, because we're doing it in one take.
Right.
And by the way, if you don't get it, we're out of time. So, you know, good luck. It's like when you watch Les Mis, you know, I can't tell you how many people have said, oh, you know, when Anne Hathaway sings her song, you see, you know, there's like some blur in the frame, the picture. It's like, really? It's like, you try it.
Yeah.
People don't realize how hard it is to be simple. And I think ultimately that's what people don't realize.
Effective acting is simple acting.
Is simple listening.
You want to replicate life. You want people to feel like they're just watching two people on a street. One of the exercises that you've given us to do, which I still do, is I just watch behavior.
Right.
And then go, okay, if you put a camera on that person and they knew the camera was on them, that behavior would change, and she wouldn't move her hair that certain way. And she'd start to be she over-dramatize her head movement and whatever. And so it's getting out of your own way. It's you know, the difference, I think, you know, some comedians, stand-up comedians, can be good actors, and some can't. And I think
who do you think are the good ones? Like, who do you like? What stand-up comedians?
Who do I think is a good actor? I think Jim Carrey's actually, when you take away sort of the Jerry Lewis sort of pratfall kind of stuff, he can be a very good. Robin Williams, I think, is a very, very good actor.
Right.
I think Louis C.K. has become a good actor and is good in the context of his own writing and what he does.
Right.
And I think the ones that are good can to be a good comedian, you have to bifurcate your mind, right? You're up there and you have to do exactly what you're not supposed to do in acting, which is be listening to what you're saying, listening to the audience, gauging how it's going. Oh, they're not going for my bits about Poland Spring Water, so I'm going to shift gears and talk about Kleenex now.
Right.
Whereas in acting, at least what I've been taught by you and others, especially you, is be in relationship, tell the story, get out of your own way, don't be listening and judging yourself.
Right.
And if you and I, you know, have worked on just turning that comedian switch off so that I'm in that relationship in a real way. And is that how important is that to good acting, not just for a comedian but anybody?
The ability to listen and be in a relationship is somewhere close to everything.
Right.
There are people who are intrinsically interesting, you know, the Bette Midlers of the world, and God bless.
Yeah.
But that's not most of us.
What do you mean by that? Interesting to watch. You'll just watch them all day.
Sure.
Right.
But that's not most of us.
Right.
And by and large, when people watch a show or they watch a movie, whether it's comedy or drama, they want to see themselves in that show or in that movie. They picture themselves. They relate in some fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if they're relating in some fashion, there must be a relationship involved somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So the performers, the people that, the sort of the Bette Midlers of the world, you love watching them, absolutely love watching them, but you don't actually think of yourself as Bette Midler.
You feel like there's a little bit of a performance you like.
Oh, sure. By the way, which is incredibly valid. I mean, I'm not saying it's not. But actors are people who, in essence, put you in their shoes and allow you to go through the experience that they're going through at the highest level.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an art form. I mean, for somebody to pretend to be somebody else in relationship to other people in such a way that you are moved is really, really quite amazing.
Talk about emotional life and explain what that is, and behavior and explain what that is in that context of acting and how they relate to each other and the importance that they have in relationship to each other.
Well, we all have, obviously we all have feelings, we all have emotions, right? What a lot of actors do is go out of their way to show you what they're feeling. Now, as a person walking around, if your boyfriend or girlfriend is going out of their way to show you what they're feeling, at some point, it gets irritating. The same is true in acting. If actors start to go out of their way to show you these things, at some point, you don't really have to listen to it because you go, oh, I get it. They're angry, and they're still angry, and they're still angry.
Is there an example you can think of a recent performance or whatever of somebody that people might know or relate to?
Yes.
If you don't want to say.
But I wouldn't want to run somebody down on the radio.
Got it.
Right. On the other hand, the ability to have feelings but take an audience through the experience of what it's like to be in that situation is really what allows people to empathize. So again, if I'm waiting tables and I'm just acting like a schmuck, at some point, 30 seconds, a minute, you'll turn me off because I'm just being a schmuck.
And it's one note.
You're watching the same thing. You're watching the same thing over and over and over again. And at some point, you're going to look at me and wonder why I would think I would ever get a tip behaving that way.
Right.
You would understand that I would feel that way, but you wouldn't expect me to behave that way if what I wanted was a tip.
Right.
And that's ultimately how they're related, right? We all get mad at our boyfriends and girlfriends. I mean, again, anybody who's ever been in a relationship will understand this. You're mad at your spouse and now you're going to tee off at your spouse.
That's your behavior. Your emotional life drives your behavior.
Right. So now, but now you're mad at your spouse, and now you decide you're just going to unload on your spouse. Where do you think that's going? Exactly. Like, what's going to happen there?
By the way, that's quintessential Bob right there. When he teaches you, that's exactly how he does it. You keep this is exactly what I was talking about earlier. You pull it out of real life, and then you go, so now what do you think is going to happen? It's Socratic method of teaching. It's brilliant.
Right.
And you get it. The light goes off, and you get it.
Right. On the other hand, if you're upset with your spouse, but you would like them to go to the movies tonight, you're going to manage your behavior at least a little bit. Out of love, out of respect, but mostly out of a desire to go to the movie tonight.
Which is more compelling to watch as a viewer because you see a guy who's feeling one way but acting another way
Correct.
To get what he wants. And that's infinitely more interesting to watch.
Absolutely.
And that's good acting. And that's good Yes. writing and good directing.
Absolutely.
It all comes together.
It all comes together. And that's why it's hard to do. Because especially in film and TV, there's so many elements to it. There's the acting and there's the directing. There's also the production design. There's the editing, which is unbelievably important. Yeah. Newsroom is a show that is brilliantly, brilliantly edited in terms of the performances and storytelling. It takes a lot of people all doing their jobs in concert and doing it well. It's one of the things I loved about working with Louis was he has the ability to get everybody pulling in the same direction.
This was on his HBO,
yeah.
first HBO show, yeah.
Which I have to tell you is, because I was on set all the time, I never laughed that hard in my life. Yeah. I mean, and the studio audience is, I mean, reeling, rollicking yeah. laughs, not an exaggeration.
Yeah, he goes for it. He really
does. He really does.
Yeah.
But he was able to get, as a leader on that set, all of those people pulling in the same direction.
Why do you think that is? What was it that rallied the people?
Because he's engaged and involved and articulate, and he knows exactly what he wants, and he knows exactly what he's doing.
He's a good leader, yeah.
And he knows how to hire people that can help him right. and move the entire thing forward. It was a great team. There's very little ego on that set, and Louis doesn't have a lot of ego in terms of working with people. But that's, I think, one of the reasons he's been successful is it's not just him. He's able to get a whole lot of people in the various departments. And obviously he has a hand in editing and, and directing and writing. But he has a hand in everything. And people love working with him. Mm-hmm. And he can get everybody moving in the same direction.
Talk about for a minute the process that an actor goes through in breaking down a script and kind of some of the, just a little bit of the nuts and bolts so people understand, like, you know, it's not just picking up a script and memorizing lines. And then, you know, because
how do they memorize those damn lines?
Exactly. And sort of what, you know, why there's training and years of training and just a little bit of the sort of the technical aspect of kind of how people get their role down.
Well, I think that's something that everybody teaches differently. I don't know that there's one way to do that. But I guess what I would say about that is, if you're talking, you know, to the person listening, let's go backwards. Imagining that you have a disagreement with your lover that ends up in some good resolution, mm-hmm. just for fun. That's the scene. You have a fight, and it ends up holding hands and going to the movies. Imagine somebody recording that. Okay, mm-hmm. and then somebody typing out the words and then handing it out as a scene. Mm-hmm. To the people who handed it out as a scene, what would you have to tell them? What would you want them to know? Right, you would want them to know certain things from your point of view, each person's point of view about why you felt the way you did and why you went about it the way that you did and what the reason was you wanted to go to the movie that night and how you... why it was important you would end up in that resolution and what you did to get to that resolution. And you might want to tell them something about your character and you might want to tell them something about your perception of the other person. So if you imagine taking a domestic scene and having it taped, recorded, I mean, and then typed out, and then you were giving it to other people, just imagine what you would want them to know. Okay, actors then have to work the other way. Because they get all they get are the pages,
So they have to create the backstory.
They have to figure all of that out.
Why is Bob arguing with Sally? And this, why is my character upset? And what
are they doing? And why was it? I see. I'm trying to get her to go to the movie tonight, but she, you know, or I want to see Kramer versus Kramer. She wants to see Road Warrior.
Talk about objective versus obstacle. Because one of the things that you teach, which I always hear in my head, is how is the scene end differently than it started, so that you take. In any scene, you take the viewer on this little bit of a journey, an arc, so it's not one note. And that within that journey, there's objective and there's obstacles, and playing objective and overcoming obstacles as part of the process.
Well, where scenes start and where they end has to do with storytelling. I mean, the essence of what a movie is a flip book. It's a series of pictures that you take. That roll out one after another that tell a story. Imagine, you know, flipping a flip book. And that's basically what a movie is. If the picture were the same from start to end, at some point you would get bored. Your mind basically, and it's a processing thing in human beings. If I look at the same picture over and over again, at some point there's no new information, well, I get bored. So the pictures have to change.
And for example, to reference back what we talked about a minute ago, if the guy's in the scene and he's just yelling the whole time and it's very clear,
you
go, okay, well, I get that this isn't going anywhere. This is boring.
Right. He's yelling guy.
Whereas if he's got an agenda and he's manipulating, the pictures are changing.
Well, again, as you said, what was your night last night? I was at the show and then I went home. It's a series of things that you did. Now, inside of that, you had feelings about it, et cetera. Anyway, you have a flip book that moves from start to end.
Right.
And that has to change. An objective basically is the thing, is the reason that gets you from the beginning to the end, right? In other words, I want you to sleep with me, right? That gets me from the beginning of the scene to the end of the scene.
That doesn't change. That's always there.
That's always there. The obstacle is simply the thing that's in your way. Right. And it's really as simple as that. Unfortunately, it gets way overcomplicated.
So there's the girl, but her guy's friend is with her, and you're not sure if her guy friend is or whatever. So there's an example of an obstacle.
There's an example.
So you might have to be kind of – so then it's like, how do I play that guy? Maybe one way you play him, and this is in the writing and the acting and the directing, is you're hostile toward him to get rid of him, or you're passive-aggressive, nice to him to kind of sweet-talk him to get rid of him.
Right.
It's about that.
Again, anybody that's ever – trying to pick a woman up at a bar or a man knows what we're talking about.
Right.
Right. You see somebody, you don't know what's going to happen next.
Right.
You have a picture in your mind that you'd like to walk out the door with that person.
Right.
Well, that's an objective. Well, now what's in your way? You don't know the person. You don't know anything about them. You don't know if they're attracted to you. You don't know anything. So now you have to go up to that person at a bar and try to figure out how you're going to get from where you're standing to moving out the door.
Right.
What most actors do is they show that problem. They show you how hard it is. They don't try to solve that problem, which would be getting the person out the door.
Explain, they show it in what way? What does that mean?
If I come up to you at a bar and I'm trying to pick you up,
right,
and that is hard for me to do, I'm not good at it. What most actors will show you is, look how bad at this I am. Look how hard this is for me. See how I'm feeling? Isn't this terrible? See how sad I am that this isn't working out? But that wouldn't make any sense, because you would be watching me do all that and you would think I was pathetic.
Right.
But if my goal is to get you out the door, I'm going to do the best I can to get you out the door.
Yeah.
So instead of showing you how hard it is, it's hard, but my focus is on getting you out the door, not on showing the audience how difficult it is to get you out the
door.
That's
playing the objective and not the obstacle.
Correct.
Right.
And then, does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. It makes total sense. And something that you can lose sight of, that's the other thing, and others have quoted, and go to Bob's website, bobkreikauer.com. It's because the Josh Duhamel, there's some great, John Slattery, there's some great actors that, and a lot of the quotes hit on the same thing, that you simplify it to the point where you go, duh, you know. But to get there, you have to have someone with your experience and your ability to sort of work with people to get you to that place where you go, oh, okay. Like, you opened up a whole other world for me as an actor, because it was very parallel to the way, like, I look at interacting with audiences, right?
Right.
It's about, like, people always say to me, well, those, that had to be a plant, that person, because it worked out so perfectly. I'm like, no, like, everybody has, yes, I called 12, I called 100 people and told them that I got their backstories, memorized it all, put it in an audience, and like, and they're like, well, you know, and it's sort of like, you listen and you react and you get out of your own way. In terms of no filters and no planning ahead of time of what you're going to say or how I'm going to react to that person. You know, I'm going to talk to you about you're wearing a vest right now. I'm going to talk to the guy about his vest because I like his vest and I don't know where it's going to go.
Right.
Now, in acting, there's a script that kind of tells you where you have to go. And the part that's always been a challenge, at least for me, is to not plan out your feelings even though you plan out the words. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It does. I mean, look, an audience, any audience, whether it's a sporting event or going to see you do your thing or a play, ultimately wants to be surprised, right? Ultimately, we all have the same job, right. And that's to make the audience want to see what will happen next. That's basically what we're trying to do.
Right.
To the degree that you give that away, the audience stops watching. That's... You know. Sadly, that's a large part of bad TV. You know, you see what's happening, and you wonder why the characters don't, and you get way ahead of the story
because you know where this train's going.
Yeah,
it's just the flip book again. That kind of it's very predictable, and you know what the next picture is going to be.
Correct. But there's a reason Law and Order's been on for the last 9 centuries, right?
Why is that?
Because, right, Dick Wolf did a really brilliant thing, which was. He, to some degree, he took the personal relationships out of the show, right? Because I think, to some degree, they can only work out so many ways. The couple gets together or they don't. The friends remain friends or they don't. I mean, there's not a lot of surprise. Everybody's relationship on that show is funneled through the crime, and everybody's relationship is funneled through who did it. And if they craft the scripts correctly, which they clearly do, the audience for the first half hour is left in doubt as to who did it. Then at the end of that half hour, they get a sense of who did it. And then in the second half hour, they go to court and find out if they got the right person.
See, right? This is surprising to me because I always felt that relationships were the key, and that's what people really keyed into. And
but their relationships here are all – because they're all work relationships. They're all – everybody's focused on the crime.
So it's always – the relationships are through the prism of the crime.
That's how they do the show, yeah, right? Everybody's focused on finding the person that did the bad thing.
If they did it another way, the other way would be not through the crime but about the personal relationships of the different people on the show, and that would lose steam after a while?
It depends. Like on NCIS, right, you have interpersonal relationships within the office – that includes some romance or possibility of romance and some banter. But a lot of the banter is the gallows humor of people doing life and death jobs. So it's all there's a reason that a billion people watch that show.
And what is that reason?
Because it's a whodunit and it's funny. So they're entertained and they get to sit on the couch and try to figure out who did it. There are probably no stories that are more compelling for human beings in general than figuring out than a mystery, who did the thing. And that's kind of what Dick Wolf did so brilliantly. He focused all of your attention on who did it. And 25 years later, people are still sitting on the couch watching reruns, right, trying to figure it out. It's like, who's going to win the Yankee game, right? Did you know Robinson Cano was going to hit a home run in the ninth inning last night? You did not.
Right.
So it has that ability to sustain your interest.
But you need a little bit of those relationship things also sprinkled in. Otherwise, it just becomes a very cold kind of...
Well, when I say the relationships are through the crime, I don't mean that they have no relationship. I mean that basically their relation, they relate to each other, but they're constantly trying to solve this one issue.
Right.
In NCIS, they dedicate, let's say it's a 44-minute show, they probably dedicate 12 to 14 minutes of the show to the banter amongst the group, right? And a lot of times that doesn't include Gibbs, who's the main character. Why? Because he stands apart. He's the boss.
Right.
Again, it's all very, whether you like the show or not, it's all incredibly well-structured and well-done in terms of storytelling. you know, it's like, oh, why do people watch that show? That's why people watch that show. Why do people watch Millionaire Show and the dancing shows and all that stuff? Because they're contests that you don't know the outcome to, and you're being entertained along the way. It's not rocket science.
This is fascinating. But again, for folks listening, you have to understand the allure and the beauty of Bob Krakauer, because when he breaks it down like that, you're right. There's a commonality that I didn't even think of until now, and I work on the Millionaire Show. And there's a reason that the same reason that people are watching NCIS are watching the Millionaire Show. There's a story being told, and you want to see what the outcome is. A Millionaire is a story of a mom who's a single mom and needs money, and how far is she going to go, and then what is she going to do with that money?
Right. They are sure to introduce just enough of a narrative.
Yes.
To give you enough of a rooting interest.
Yes. That people always ask me, how do you get on the show? Do you pass the test? I'm like, no, that's only half of it. You better have an interesting story. I actually tell people, make something up. Say you saved a puppy from a well. You know? Say you have three testicles, whatever it is. But like, make something up, because they want compelling stories, because people will not stay tuned to that show if it's just about the hard dollars.
Correct. Because after a while, there's nothing to engage with. So when you're dealing with actors, in essence, even if they're doing Chekhov or Ibsen or whatever it is, even though they all see it as high art and, you know, God bless, but it still, Ibsen was a guy and Chekhov was a guy, and they still wrote stories about people, and they're still stories. And you're trying to engage your audience in the same way. You don't want them to get ahead. You want them to be interested in what's going to happen next.
Talk about the different mediums, television, live theater, and film, and the demands are different on the actor and the director in those mediums, and talk about that a little bit.
Well, in theater, you're rehearsing a story so that you can do it 8 times a week. And as such, it's probably going to be more set, especially in a musical.
How do you keep that spontaneous as the actor? How do they do that?
It's really hard. Because there's actually a phrase that the union uses. I can't remember if it's the directors or the actors, where they'll say the show is locked, which I think is bizarre. But the show is locked. What does that mean? It means that, okay, we've rehearsed, we've decided that these are the things we're doing, and now we can't deviate from them. Now, inside of that, you want to stay as spontaneous as you can. But if you're in Jersey Boys, and there's 1,000 light cues going off, and you have to turn to the right because you can't turn to the left. I'm not really, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's really hard to do.
Right.
And the only way to stay alive in those shows is for you and I in relationship to listen as if it's the first time. We have to do it constantly as if it's the first time. So I'm looking you in the eye, you're looking me in the eye.
It's what I have to do with stand-up. I have to tell that joke, that story.
Yeah, I would imagine the same thing, right? Because every audience is different.
You have to find some way to make that, like, I'm telling you, this is, it's, yeah.
Right, and I would guess that the energy in the club's different every night.
Oh, yeah.
So, in essence, the club, the folks in the club become your scene partner. It's the same idea. When you say keep it fresh, Bono, I just read this interview with Bono, and he called it the presentness of now. In other words, you're playing the same song sometimes for 20 or 30 years on these tours, but you're playing it tonight for the first time to this audience right now. And being present, being engaged with you right now, like, I have no idea how this interview is going. I'm enjoying talking to you. I have no idea how it's coming out or not coming out.
Right.
And if we sat down to have this conversation again, it wouldn't go exactly the same way.
No, first of all, we'd be pantsless. So I'd do it without pants.
Yeah, because that way I'd be more, it's a little hot in my chair. That's how you.
But are there technical things that the actor has to do on stage? Obviously project, they're not mic'd, that kind of thing, but maybe play, I think, a little bigger because you're playing a house, whereas, you know.
Oh, on theater? Yeah.
Television, film, you want to be smaller. You know, some of the technical things that people may not be aware of that a person has to do.
Well, in film and TV, again, you know, if you're listening to this, pick up your iPhone, right? Turn on the video thing and take a video of the person in front of you talking. If they talk any louder than they need to cover the distance between the two of you, or if they gesticulate wildly in a way that you can't keep your camera on them, you're going to have a crappy video.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So you need the person that you're taking a picture of to adjust to the machinery you have in your hand.
Right.
And it's not any more complicated than that. In the theater, you have people who are sitting in a Broadway house 30 feet, 50 feet, 100 feet, 200 feet up in the sky. They need to hear you, and they need to see you. So now you're trying to cover that distance. Mm-hmm. And that's ultimately what it is. You're trying to cover the distance between you and wherever your audience is. In a movie, taking the same iPhone, in a movie, if I'm going to project it on a 30-foot screen, then I don't have to do a lot of moving to get your attention because my face is 30 feet large.
Right, right. It'll be a little much. But there is a difference in film acting and television acting that you've talked about.
Yeah, I think so.
And what is that difference?
Television scripts tend to be more plot-driven because the nature of TV is I've got 22 or 44 minutes to tell a story. And even in shows where they're episodic in nature, like Orange is the New Black, let's say, each episode has to stand alone. So you're talking more than you would in a film. A film, you're basically telling one story. There may be sort of ancillary stories involved, but you're basically telling one story over a two-hour period. And so more of that story can be told without words. So there's a lot more behavior and a lot more, not a lot, it depends on the script. Like Judd Apatow was a TV writer, and his scripts tend to sort of continue to reflect that.
Yeah, there's a lot of that quick dialogue back and forth.
Right, there's a lot of talking. But Terrence Malick, you know, Tree of Life, they're literally pages with no dialogue on them because you can allow the pictures to tell more of the story because you're really only telling one.
In film.
Yeah. You know,
why not try to tell just one main story in television? Is it because it's broken up by commercials and it?
Well, you can. There's two issues. The story would have to be between 13 and 24 hours long, right? So let's start there. That's quite a lot of time to sustain.
You remember the course of a season.
Right. To sustain a single story. Mm. The other reason is you're talking about an audience that is busy and they may miss an episode, right? They did that with 24, right?
Oh, yeah.
And it was pretty successful. Well, I think at the time of 24, I had a 3-year-old. So there was no way I was watching 24 because once you missed an episode, you were screwed.
Right.
Well, the networks don't like that. They don't like that because if you miss an episode and I'm screwed, then I'm probably not going to watch the show.
Right.
So I think that's part of the genius now of Netflix is you can binge watch these shows.
Get it. Yeah.
And so somebody with a 3-year-old after the baby goes down, they're boom. Let's watch the first six.
Stay awake.
Right. Let's watch the first six episodes of House of Cards until 4 a.m. But you can.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It is better for the storytellers. It absolutely is.
And then when, as a director in those mediums, and you've worked in all of them, what are the demands? How are they different as a director? In sort of getting the best performances and telling the story effectively?
Well, in a studio movie, let's say you know, like some big movie, I can't think of X-Men or whatever it is, you're shooting 2.5 pages a day, 2 pages, 3 pages. In television, you're shooting 7 pages a day, 8 pages a day, and they tend to be more dialogue heavy. Mm-hmm. So you have less time, you have less takes, the actors have to be better prepared. There's less room for spontaneity in terms of improvisation because I only have 12 hours to shoot these 8 pages, so I'm not going to mess around.
Right.
I'm going to try to get done what I need to get done, and then if I have a little time, I'll do something.
Right.
If you're in a movie and you're shooting 2-3 pages a day, you have a lot more time. Now, obviously, in independent movies, you're shooting more than that. In theater, you're rehearsing for 5 weeks to put on a 2-hour production.
That is set and doesn't change. And
a set and relative to film and TV doesn't change.
Right.
I mean, I just directed a play here in New York, and because I spent so much time doing film and TV, I nearly lost my mind because I'm used to working
quickly,
and I was like, what is with all the time? Oh, God. It's just horrifying.
You worked as a casting director at ABC, MTV, NYPD Blue, a lot of big shows. What is, explain, again, this is for the people that have very, like, are viewers, everybody's a viewer, but doesn't really understand what's happening behind the scenes. Like, what is the role of the casting director, and what is a big pitfall that actors fall into in auditioning for casting directors, generally, in your experience?
Well, the role of a casting person, wow, that's a tough question, because there's that.
Really? I didn't even know I knew what I was doing. All right, yeah. Good.
Well, it is, because it depends. They do a lot of different things. And Deb Aquila, who I think is one of the truly terrific casting people, mm-hmm. excuse me, Deb's ability to read a script, right, and really be able to articulate why this actor would be better for a role than that actor. Mm-hmm. In my experience, Deb, the Zane sisters, Bonnie and Deborah, Gail Pillsbury.
What are some of the shows that they've cast?
Oh, geez.
HBO stuff?
Well, Deb was in charge of Paramount for a long time, so whatever came out of Paramount for the 5, 6, 7 years. Zane Pillsbury right now is doing Graceland, Modern Family. They do a lot of different shows. Deborah Zane, for a while, I think, was doing all of Steven Spielberg's. I mean, they do some pretty major films.
But what are some of them, like, what are the comical or otherwise, the things that you've seen come in, you know, cast, as a casting director, what is your role there? You're sort of the liaison between the actor and the director and the producer, right, to try to find these people that they envision in this play or this script?
Well, I think there's three aspects to the casting. One is the part that nobody can do anything about, which is like dating, right? You remind me of my brother. You're in. You remind me of my brother. You're out. You know, right? And that's, you know, that's the director and the producers. There's, you know, there's no explanation for taste. I find that person attractive. I think that person's not attractive. I mean, there's nothing you can do about that.
The subjectivity of it all, which is the bane of
everybody's existence, because everybody tries to reduce it to a science, and it's really not.
Which I tried to do for a while, coming out of the law background and stuff. I was always so logical about things, and it's like, well, I did this and I did this, and so I should have that. And it's like, no, it's like, you know,
no, it's like, it really, you might as well be asking, why won't that girl go out with me?
Yeah, exactly.
And the answer is, I don't know. She likes me. She says I'm a great guy. She says I'm smart. Right. She says I'm attractive, and she says I'm funny. But she won't go out with me is a big part of casting.
Yeah, exactly.
The second part of casting is, do you understand the material that I just handed to you, if you're the actor? Yeah. Do you get this? Do you know what's going on here? Do you understand these scenes? Do you understand the relationships? The third part, which was probably where most of the many misunderstood Americans reside, is in the business side, because network presidents, studio people, they have a job, and their job doesn't necessarily have to do with acting. There's a show I did at HBO, I won't say which one, and we thought we had the cast. We were actually moving away from the table, and the then head of HBO, who is not the current head of HBO, said, you know what? I'm looking at my board here, and I realize that I'm kind of low on the ethnicity side. Do you have anybody in this particular part who would fill that bill? And we can all sit around and say that that's terrible or horrible, but
it's the reality of the business.
It's the reality of the business.
You want to bring that population to the table to watch your show, to feed the beast and make the money.
And to satisfy, you know, certain needs that the company may have in terms of casting, in terms of ethnicity. But that meant that an actress we were about to hire, literally about to hire, ended up losing a job for that reason. You know, you may not like that,
right,
but that's what happened.
Well, you give us lessons and talk about what you should and shouldn't do when you go in as an actor into casting calls. And I think it's applicable in life, whether it's a job interview or dealing with people in your life on a personal level, and how you should behave and how in the mental state that you should be in when you go in.
Deranged is probably not a good way to go in,
deranged,
Paul.
Deranged and needy.
Deranged and needy is not attractive to most people.
Weeping. But talk about...
Stay on your side of the table. Don't kiss the casting person.
Right. Don't come in with your dick sticking out.
Not a good idea. Unless you have bells hanging from it, in which case, by all means, don't let me stop you.
But talk about the mental state that you should be in as the... Because I think it's applicable in life. Like, if you could take this sort of advice and this guidance.
Well, I think... I think... a little bit of a fuck it attitude, like, I'm just going to have some fun here. I don't really care what anybody thinks of me.
Right.
I like to act, and I'm going to, instead of looking at this as a job interview, I'm going to look at it as an opportunity to act.
Right.
I think a little bit of a fuck you attitude is also good, too. Just a touch.
Right. That's the fine line.
Right. That's the fine line. Just a hair of, you know what? Back the fuck up. Okay, make some room for me.
Yeah.
I'm doing my thing.
Right,
I think is important. And I think a little bit of, you know, fuck me. A little bit of, you know, a touch of humble would be nice.
Yeah,
you know. But I think ultimately, if you enjoy acting and you enjoy doing the scenes that you've been given to do,
right.
And you don't try to impress anybody, the chances of them being impressed, paradoxically, are probably higher.
Yeah.
It's, you know, everybody, oh, don't be selfish. Well, I don't know. I would act out there for your own enjoyment, you know, and have a good time doing the scenes and let the chips fall where they may. Because you can't, in the same way I can't make somebody go out with me, and trust me, I can't make anybody go out with me.
Come on, you're adorable.
I'm not adorable. Anywhere. My wife, who I love and adore, is blind as a bat. you can't make that happen. But what you can do is be a good enough presence in the room and understand the material well enough and do a good enough job that you force people to consider
right. You.
And I think ultimately that's important because going back to the casting question, when you're auditioning for producers and directors and they see you as a viable choice, the casting people then see you as a viable choice for the next thing. And that opens up a door.
That's a really good point. I'm glad you brought that up because a lot of times people don't realize, you know, almost every actor, they didn't get this thing, but they get kept in mind and they get brought back in. And
that's correct.
I call it getting closer and closer to the bullseye. You know,
when
if you do good work, the word spreads, if you're easy to work with. You were in Louisville for 6 years working there. Was that your biggest training ground? And what did you think you knew then as a teacher that you look back and go, oh, God, I can't believe I was given that advice or I would teach that way that you don't do anymore?
I've blanked it out. I've removed that part of my brain. I don't even remember who that person was, and I'm sorry to everybody I met at that time.
You made everybody pretend to be a goat and run around the do all those method acting.
I did. There's a lot of mooing going on. Here's why I was in a way it was great because what John Jury, who ran it, who was very, very kind to me, basically said, look, here's the budget.
And tell people the name of the theater there was what?
Actors Theater of Louisville.
Right.
And John basically said, look, I was 25 or whatever I was. Here's the budget. Don't go over budget. Do what you want. Don't break my theater. And what it allowed me to do was make an amazing number of mistakes, in essence, out of the limelight.
Yeah.
Now, eventually what happened was, for various reasons I won't go into here because it's too long and boring, because of some things we did, we actually ended up in the limelight. We ended up like on Entertainment Tonight and all this other stuff, which was extremely odd. But
wait, you were on Entertainment Tonight doing what?
I wasn't the
production?
No, the actress, the company that I ran ended up.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a long story, but the bottom line was he basically gave me he did a great thing for me. He gave me carte blanche, but within a very defined space. Mm-hmm. So if I failed miserably, it wasn't going to hurt anybody, because the theater, the structure that was the theater, would have prevented whatever disasters or calamities.
Do you remember any of the mistakes, the big mistakes that you think you made? That, and looking back, you're like, oh, that was just a young guy that didn't have it together yet.
Yeah.
You don't want to talk.
Sure.
About.
No, I mean, one of the ways. One of the ways that I arrived at some of the things that I arrived at was because I did a bunch of things that didn't work.
Oh, okay.
Whether they were theater games or improv, you know, step into the picture of your life.
And, oh, there you go.
You know, all that.
Touchy-feely,
you know, crawl around on the floor and sniff the whatever.
Yeah. be the flower.
Be the flower. See the flower. Okay. Be the flower. The reason I know that stuff doesn't generically work is because I saw it. It didn't. I mean, what happens with those exercises, and I mean no disrespect to teachers that do them, because I do understand their value. There's a value in them, but the value is not in picking up that piece of paper with those words on it and turning that thing into a scene.
Well, what does it do for you to be able to? And what we're talking about is there are exercises where you pretend to be a panther in the wild, and they will literally have you crawl around on the floor or make a panther noise and behave like a panther. And there's this, I don't know if it's apocryphal, the story of Marlon Brando, his actor studio, and it's like, okay, you are all chickens and a bomb is about to drop, and a nuclear bomb. And so everybody in the room runs around like a crazy chicken with literally their head cut off, and Marlon Brando just sits there and pecks at the floor, and someone said to him, why aren't you? He goes, well, I'm a chicken. How would I know that a bomb is coming?
Well,
when a bomb is?
Exactly. And I actually think, you know, it's very hard at this moment because I want to be respectful and polite. And there's another part of me that wants
just
to go.
Say it.
That wants
first of
to
all,
go.
Nobody listens to this anyway.
Person wants to go Dennis Leary crazy.
Yeah.
Because I just think it's bullshit.
Yeah. Well, say it.
Well, it's bullshit. Bullshit. Because
you don't have to call anybody out specifically.
No. But it's just. It's just a lot of wasted class time working on people's imagination and on their. Here's the deal: if you don't have an imagination, if you can't, or conversely, you're not in touch with your own experience, one or the other will do.
Right.
All the animal barking and fucking in the world isn't going to help you pick up a script and do a scene.
Right.
You know, feel the candle, be the candle, right? My daughter, who's 14, who I worship the ground she walks on, came home from school. They were doing, oh, my God, I'm going to get killed. Really, I'm going to hell for this. She came home. My 14-year-old came home. She's taking a theater class at the school. And I said, how'd it go? She goes, well, we walked around in the circle. And the teacher was like, walk around like you're cold. Now walk around like you're hot. She goes, and everybody's like, you know, like, crossing their hands over their chest and shaking like anybody actually does that when they walk the streets of New York. I'm like, well, you are correct. She goes, right, but I'm going to fail the class because the teacher said I wasn't acting cold. And I looked at her, I was like, I put my hands in my pockets and I put my hood on and I keep walking.
Right, exactly.
So a lot of that, sorry, I moved the microphone there. A lot of that stuff, you know, I had time at Louisville to try a lot of it, and I did a lot of it, and it was just a waste of fucking time. It just was awful.
Well, so it goes back to what you say. It's about telling stories in relationship and having people relate to those characters that they see themselves in.
Well, yeah, and Louisville was great because in those days, the festival, the New American Play Festival, I mean, Howard Korder, Arthur Coppett, Jane Anderson, the Moscow Art Theater, I mean, everybody came through there, actors, Holly Hunter and Frances McDormand and all these great people, and John himself, who was really quite smart.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually they all basically were always asking the same question. Like, they'd see something, they would go, well, John, you say, Mr. Krakauer, that's very interesting what those students are doing, but what are they doing, right? I don't understand what I'm watching. I get that they're bleeding from the eyeballs. I'm very happy for them. What are they doing? And so you quickly learn that as emotional or as wonderful as anything is, if the audience can't follow it, it's meaningless.
It's It's just a fascinating thing that you do, and yet you're able to kind of break it down for people and make it simple, because I feel like it's a profession where it's been run by a lot of people that feel like the more complicated it is, the more artistic it is. And I don't necessarily think that's the case. I mean, the beauty of what you do is you simplify it for the actor. So you can kind of do exactly what you're telling people today, which is, hey, I'm telling a story that was on a piece of paper, and I'm going to bring it to life through visuals, and you're going to relate to my character, and you're going to see me in relationship, and it's as simple as that. And a lot of people lose sight of that, I think. You know?
Well, I think a lot of classes and a lot of teaching, what happens is the teachers themselves try to create a situation in which they hold some secret that nobody else has.
Yeah.
And they try to make it, you know, so that only the very special ones understand it.
Right.
The truth of the matter is people have been acting, you know, since the Pleistocene era. So, like, you know.
Get over it.
Get over it.
Yeah.
And like I said earlier, it's something that, as human beings, to, you know, to obviously greater success or failure, we all do somewhat naturally all day long just to get through our day.
Yeah. Well, you're the best. I love you.
I love you too.
I can't thank you enough for doing this. It was fun. I think people are going to really enjoy like getting into the weeds on how all this stuff works, because I don't think a lot of people really understand that. At least my relatives don't. Yeah, so-and-so sucks as an actor. That was terrible. Oh, you're right about Les Mis, by the way. So many people ragging on that movie. It's like, really? I don't know. It looked pretty good to me. But you're the best. Bob Krakauer, BobKrakauer.com.
Thanks, Paul.
If anybody wants to act, you need to call this guy. You're the best.
Thank you, Paulie.
We're going to go have drinks and dinner sometime.
Make love.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Put your pants back on.
Okay, I will.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Take over one borough at a time. Secure our territory. Secure our turf. Because it's all our turf.